All right. Well, it's great to be with you. And so I want us to just jump right in right away here. If we can put my slides up, that would be great. Or I can just advance it. All right. We'll see how that goes. Do we got it? Maybe the remote needs to be on. That always helps a great deal. All right. Let's see. We got it? I think. There we go. All right. Big why question. So here's the why question I want us to explore with my time. Here it is. Why does it just feel so hard to do ministry right now? Or why does it just feel so hard to be a congregation? And we're just going to answer it right off the bat. And the reason is because of the secular. So that's it. Thank you all very much. It's been great to be with you. That sarcastic clap makes me feel bad, actually. You're supposed to say, oh. All right, so here's the problem. When you say anything is the secular, it doesn't take but 2 seconds to realize the secular is an incredibly complicated word. And just one conversation with people on the secular is impacting this or that, and you start to realize the way you define the secular and the way they define the secular is not quite in congruence. So I want us to unfold. With my time, I'm going to unfold this word. What do we mean when we say the secular? And I think there's a lot at stake here, because if we're not clear on what we mean by the secular, even out of our best intentions, our practices may make matters worse. That even out of our best intentions, they may make them worse. So to do this unfolding, I want to take you on a bit of a journey. I want to take you on a little bit of a historical journey. I don't want you to think of this just as historical, but we do have to do a little bit of historical work. This congregation, I think, gets us in the historical vibes. I mean, we can kind of feel history here. So what I want you to do with me is go back in time, and let's go back about 600 years. Let's stay in the West, but let's go somewhere exotic and cool. So let's go to the streets of Paris. So if we were on the streets of Paris in the 14th century, we would be walking around the Latin Quarter in a society where there was no secular. That the dial of the secular was zero. Now, people weren't ignorant. They knew when they went to the cathedral that the chalice the priest gave the Eucharist in was sacred, and a shovel or a hoe used in the farm was profane. And by that, I simply mean not used in holy activity. But for the most part, all of these things fit together. It was nearly impossible to live in a secular zero age and not believe. There were no atheists. There wasn't even a word for atheism at the time. It was very, very hard to not believe, to be an atheist in secular zero. As a matter of fact, this is a statue that you can find in Venice, Italy. It's a statue of a man named Paolo Sarpi. I don't know if you know who Paolo Sarpi is. What he's most famous for is being Galileo's friend. So Paolo Sarpi encouraged Galileo to write his book that ended up getting him in hot water with the Catholic Church. Now, you can find this off the Grand Canal, and if you go and find it, you will see it. And it's sitting on top of a pedestal, and on that pedestal is a plaque. And this is what the plaque says. It says, Paolo Sarpi, date of birth, date of death, and then there's a quote in Italian. And if you don't speak Italian, you'll have to find a hunky Italian man to translate it for you, which is a great pickup line if you need it. You can thank me for that. And they'll translate it for you, and this is what it says in Italian. It says, Paolo Sarpi, the only unbeliever of his generation. Paolo Sarpi, the only unbeliever of his generation. We're talking early 16th century. But if in the early 16th century you don't believe and you die, you go down in infamy. You get a statue. Now, the traffic in New York City was really bad, but I could imagine if there was a statue for every unbeliever in New York City, your Uber ride would be a lot longer, I think. But you can see it's nearly impossible to not believe when you live in a secular zero age. I don't know what it even would be like to be a late modern person like we are and go back to secular zero. I don't think it's possible, to be quite honest. But I'm not sure how you would do it. What would that look like? I only know one thought experiment that's tried to imagine what it would look like to be a late modern society and go all the way back to secular zero. And it's a little dystopian TV show called The Handmaid's Tale. I don't know if you've seen The Handmaid's Tale. If you haven't seen The Handmaid's Tale and you want to be freaked out, just go start streaming episodes of The Handmaid's Tale. But if you know anything about this TV series, you know they're based off books by a Canadian author named Margaret Atwood. And what Margaret Atwood does is she imagines, Canadians represent, I got a joke coming for you, so just hold on. But Atwood imagines what would happen if America fell. there was no more America, and a group has taken them over called Gilead that's taken them back to secular zero. Now, it's a dystopian piece of literature, and to say that America has fallen, America doesn't exist, isn't quite true. If you know the TV show, you know the books, you know America does exist, but as a small enclave in Toronto. Like, there's America in diaspora in Toronto. And I know this is dystopian literature, but if you ask me, it's fantasy literature. Because you talk to any Canadian, what they really yearn for is America to be a small enclave in Toronto. That is the most luscious thing any Canadian can ever imagine. They will never admit it to you, but that's what they deeply, deeply long for. That's the eschaton for Canadians. That and maybe the Toronto Maple Leafs winning a playoff series. But we won't go there. All right. So we're off track big time now. So there is this kind of imagination of how can you get back there. And Margaret Atwood thinks it's a nightmare. It's a frightening, frightening dystopian nightmare to imagine that you could be modern and go all the way back to secular zero. Now, she thinks it's a nightmare because you need three things to live in a secular zero society that I'm not quite so sure we have anymore. And these three things you need to have is you need to have a deep sense that the world is an enchanted place. That there are devils and demons everywhere, and they do things. And particularly, they can get locked inside of things themselves. So there are certain things that if you touch them, they can radiate into your being, into the essence of your being. Your being is so porous that if you touch those things, they can make you holier. Or you touch other things, they could corrupt your essence. So you have to have this sense of enchantment, of things being imbued with a divine or an evil force, and that things can get right into the essence of yourself. Now, there's a great book written by a historian named Keith Thomas, who teaches at Oxford. He wrote this book called Religion in the Decline of Magic. One of my favorite stories in that book is he says in the 13th century, there was a crisis going on across the church. And what they discovered across England was that people were going to take communion and the host was being put on their tongue. And then they were leaving the cathedral without swallowing it. They were holding it in their mouth. And then they were going home. They were taking it out, feeding it to their sick pig, putting it on their field to get a better crop yield, not because they were denigrating it. Not because they held it in low esteem, but because they held it in the highest esteem. And if you needed that pig to survive to feed your family, or you needed a good crop yield this year, why not put a little of the very host of Jesus on it? Well, you can imagine bishops, priests, cardinals, very uncomfortable with this, very upset. So they called everyone to gather to figure out what they were going to do about this. Like the theme of the annual conference was, come and let's discuss the biggest issue we face, how to get people to swallow the host. And people are like, oh, I'll walk for 100 miles to hear that. That seems really interesting. So they got everyone in a room to try to figure out how are you going to get people to swallow the host. And some genius in the room, I don't know who this person was, raised his hand. They called on him. And he said, well, I have an idea. Why don't we make people stick out their tongues? And now you know if you watch any Italian or Irish gangster movie, especially if it has a kind of Scorsese vibe to it, you know there's always the scene where there is a first communion and a montage of murders at the same time. Perfect alibi for the mob boss, you know, you get the metaphor is so rich, Scorsese way, spilled blood. But you see it, the mob boss goes to the altar to take communion, hands go behind back, tongue goes out, only priest can touch the host, puts it on tongue, swallows it, and then like a four-year-old with a sore throat at the doctor's office shows the priest that they've swallowed the host. That goes back in some Catholic traditions back to the 13th century, back to this crisis. The other thing they did was ratchet up the rhetoric. They reminded people, if you misuse the host, this is the most sacred thing we have, you will bring eternal damnation on yourself. Do not misuse the host. We know from historians for the next 100 years, it became church law that you had to take communion twice a year, and most people took it twice a year. They were absolutely frightened taking it, shaking as they went before it. But it was better than the alternative, which is if you took it not at all, you would burn in hell forever. So take it twice a year. You may not survive it, but you better do it. Now, I have a son who's a freshman in college, and I want you to know that I love this boy. I would die for this boy. And he's growing up his freshman year away. But when he was in high school, this kid was an incredible pain in the ass. I'm sorry, I don't mean to say that. He was just a contrarian. If I said the sky was blue, he would go on a rant on how, no, it was orange. Like anything we did, he took the opposite view. In the little church that I worship in, that my wife's the pastor of in South Minneapolis, when we take communion, we take it in a circle. It's this beautiful moment where the words of institution go over the elements. A basket of bread goes around one side. The cup follows it. And we have this moment where we can look someone in the eye, say their name, and give them the elements. It's incredibly beautiful. So this is happening this particular Sunday. My wife is leading communion at about 12 o'clock. My son and I are standing at 6 o'clock. The basket of bread starts coming around, and my son turns to me. He's probably a sophomore in high school at this time. He turns to me, and he whispers, but it's kind of a stage whisper. It's pretty loud. And he says, "Hey, is that bread gluten-free? Is that gluten-free bread?" Now, you need to know this boy hates everything gluten-free. Just hates everything gluten-free. He thinks it's disgusting. He doesn't think it's real bread. I think he thinks it's a scam from Big Bread or something like that. I don't know. This kid hates everything gluten-free. And he hates it because, well, naturally, his mother's gluten-free. So this is something that he must deny. So I know this is going to be a problem. So he asked me, "Is this bread gluten-free?" And I sigh and I don't even look at him. And I say, yeah, it's gluten-free. This is what this kid does. He leans over to me and in a louder stage whisper goes, "Well, then I'm out," and turns around and walks out of church. Now, this is a confession, so don't at me, as the kids say. This is a confession. It took everything in me to not tackle the boy and beat him in front of the church that day. But just think of that incredible different imagination of a medieval person going before the altar, shaking, not sure what would happen when this holy thing would touch their sinful tongue, to my sophomore in high school son, who's like, "You know what? I don't like the texture of gluten-free, and this will make my mom really annoyed, so I'm out." Very, very different imagination. But you see in those stories how all of these three things, all these three realities play, and how he doesn't really hold to any of them. So in a secular zero age, what really ends up mattering when we kind of think about what the church does or what the minister or pastor does, it's really about giving people access. Access out of the demonic world, access out of evil and sin. You give them access into the holy. You give them access into some kind of form of righteousness through these practices. But this only sets up what we would ever mean by the secular. It has to come out of this reality. The secular arrives when something very, very dynamic happens that we all live with, that we almost don't even see it. That it happens, and we'll call this secular one, it starts to happen when we have a divide between what is public and what is private. When we start to live that there's a difference between what is public and what is private. Many historians will say most medieval people didn't really have a sense of what was public and what was private. But we, as modern people, all live with some kind of sense of the difference between what is public and what is private. Think about it like this. Someone in your life, an aunt, a grandmother, your father, someone told you that when you go to a dinner party, there are four topics you should never talk about at a dinner party. You remember these, right? The first one you should never talk about, well, it's very rude to ask someone about how much money they make. When we're at coffee next, do not come up to someone and say, "Hey, nice shirt, how much money do you make?" Like, it's a very rude thing to do that. Second thing you're not supposed to talk about was you're not supposed to talk about politics. Now, that's nearly impossible in our day and age because politics has become entertainment, so it's like, what else would you talk about but politics? But you are not supposed to talk about politics. The third thing that's probably held on with us is that you are not supposed to talk about sex, right? It would be very rude to ask someone about their sex life as you're meeting them for the first time. And then what's the fourth thing? The fourth thing that you are not supposed to talk about is religion. Okay, there it is. So money, politics, sex, and religion. Why are those the four topics you are not supposed to talk about at a dinner party? The reason you're not supposed to talk about those four areas is because the presumption is those are all private realities. And polite people do not talk about private things in public. This radically changes our imagination. When belief becomes a private thing and not a public thing, we enter into a secular age. We enter into the possibilities of the secular. The secular starts to build off, it dawns, and then it starts to take different form off of this transition where belief becomes a private thing. Pastoral ministry, congregational life, becomes something very different when you are dealing with people who are private people who come to a public space to either learn things for their private belief or to express their private belief, but it becomes very different. So we get a transition here then that it's no longer enchantment and things and a poor self, but what really matters is wills. It's not really purely rational, but now belief somehow happens inside of you. It's something you will to. It's something that you consent to. Now, let me help you make this connection by showing you a clip. And this clip comes from the PBS NewsHour. And this happened, this was the evening, you remember when this occurred. It was before the pandemic, so it's hard to remember anything before the pandemic. But to remember when we got word through social media or whatever that Notre Dame in Paris was on fire, remember that? All right, so I want to show you a clip from the news that night, and they are interviewing a woman. You'll see her name come up, and you'll see her title come up. She's like the dean of the Episcopal Chapel in Paris. And I want you to listen to how she talks about this. And I'm showing you this not to throw any shade on her. This is exactly how I would answer. But it's a very different imagination outside of that secular zero one, moving into the secular one. So listen to how she talks about the experience of Notre Dame being on fire. Almost as if I paid her to say that. It illustrates this point so well. And again, I should just say, this is, I don't think she's wrong. If you were to ask me, this is exactly how I would answer. But a very different imagination. She says, okay, Jesus crown of thorns. Is it really Jesus crown of thorns? I mean, is the thing itself really Jesus crown of thorns? Maybe, probably not, but that doesn't matter. What matters is the faith invoked in people. People prayed with it. What matters, where the action is happening, is somehow inside. How well people are coming to will this and come to consent to this. So this becomes a time where that really matters, where belief becomes something, again, it's not purely rational, but it's something that you do internal, something that you hold to, something that you consent to in some way. This is why every modern denomination that we are all living in, most of us living in, every modern denomination can only exist for one more generation. Every modern denomination can only exist for one more generation. Now, let me be clear. I am not saying every modern denomination will only exist for one more generation, but I'm saying every modern denomination knows this. They know if the next generation does not decide to enact their life inside that denomination, there is no reason and there is no way it will continue. So if you do not get the next generation to decide to be United Methodists, there will be no United Methodist denomination, no PCUSA denomination. All mainline denominations are very aware that if the next generation does not willfully consent to be in that denomination and express their private beliefs publicly in that denomination, there will be no denomination. That's why most mainline denominations every 3 years have some kind of youth gathering where they gather and spend a lot of money gathering young people. In a really, really creative way, the ELCA has one that's called the Youth Gathering. They didn't want to spend any money on creative names, but they have one. Every 3 years, they spend millions of dollars gathering the young people of the denomination, and it becomes a kind of pep rally to American Lutheranism, at least within the ELCA. It becomes a kind of pep rally. I was at one a few years ago, and there are speakers. It's usually in some kind of arena setting, and then next to the convention center. And it was a very, very exciting one, and the young people were just having a great time. And I ended up to be day three, creepy guy listening to high school girls talk. I didn't mean to be, but I was trying to walk through the convention center and these two girls that looked like they're like juniors in high school in front of me, and I was trying to get past them, but I couldn't get past them, so I just had to wait till the hallway opened up. So I started, I was just waiting. I happened to listen to what they were saying. Now, in my memory, they were from California. I'm not sure that's true, but it's more fun to tell the story if they're from California. So I'm behind them, and they're walking, and they are loving this experience. They're having a great time. And they're walking side by side, and one of the girls, in a kind of teasing, loving way, if that's possible, kicks her friend. She does that kind of thing, where you kick your friend. And so the girl gets kicked, knows immediately that her friend kicked her. And she looked at her and played it up. And this is where it's more fun if they're from California. She goes, "Oh my gosh, like I can't like believe you just kicked me. And I'm listening to this, waiting to get past. But then she says this. She says, I can't believe you like just kicked me. She goes, that is such an un-Lutheran thing to do. And it stopped me in my tracks. And I thought to myself, un-Lutheran? An un-Lutheran thing to do. Like, she didn't say, hey, that's an unethical thing to do, or that's an unbiblical thing to do. She said, that's an un-Lutheran thing to do. And then I thought to myself, you know, if her friend would have put her arm around her and said, you know, we're hearing all this stuff about justification by faith alone, but I want you to know that your works really matter. That, people, would have been incredibly un-Lutheran. That would have been an incredibly un-Lutheran thing to do. But kicking your friend wasn't un-Lutheran, but she got exactly why the denomination just poured millions of dollars into this event. She was trying on, at least for 4 days, of what it would mean to imagine herself as a Lutheran. Would it last 4 weeks or 4 years or till she's 44? Probably not. It doesn't matter. We got to try, because if the next generation does not decide to enact their life out in this expression of the denomination, it will not exist. So you see how the will, how consent plays within this, how we even start to think of belief starts to function this way. The second piece here is we move from living in a cosmos to living in a universe. Remember when this happened, and there's probably a better slide for this now, but it would be too fresh for us. But remember when January 31st, 2018 happened? This was when there was the super red blood moon. Now we could look at the eclipse, and some of the places you lived, you saw the eclipse. One of my most enjoyable things to do with groups of pastors in a room is to say, you remember this date, you remember it well, because you never did more pastoral care calls than 2 weeks before this and 10 days after that. Remember this? Remember how many pastoral care calls you had? You're still exhausted from those 2 weeks of all the pastoral care calls. And then you see the existential tremor go through the group because no one was. And they're like, were you? I wasn't. I wasn't busy. Were you busy? I wasn't busy. Well, this was the date of the super red blood moon. And in a different kind of imagination, you could imagine that you had a ton of pastoral care calls. People called you up and said, Pastor, I'm thinking of taking a new job. But now I hear there's going to be this super red blood moon. Should I or should I not? Or, Pastor, we're trying to have a baby, but now there's a super red blood moon. What is God trying to tell us? Should we do this or shouldn't we do this? No one, I'll say that, no one did pastoral care calls on this. But in a different kind of imagination, you would. In a cosmos, you imagine even the natural phenomena has a message. There's something in it. That there's a story going on even out in the natural world, and you need someone to help you discern that, to understand what's going on. But at the very least, it tells you that belief is somewhere out there. It's something happening out there. But we don't live in a cosmos. We live in a universe, and everything gets locked inside of our own heads, and even the natural phenomenon just becomes Instagrammable, but it doesn't mean anything. Doesn't really mean anything. There's no larger story in this. It's just, you know, it's a mathematical equation. We know when the next one is going to come. So you see how this transitions things in a secular one world, that what really matters and what good ministry is and what the good pastor does is help people demonstrate. As the public person who tries to impact people's private beliefs, the church becomes a place where you can go and demonstrate your private beliefs publicly. It becomes a very different way of doing ministry. But it clicks forward to something that I think is quite dangerous for us right now. And it tends to be the way we always define what the secular is. You ask people to define the secular, and they almost always give you a secular two definition. So secular two would be this. If secular one is a public-private divide, secular two is the kind of classic way we talk about this. This is the way the media always talks about the secular. Secular two is that fewer and fewer people are going to church. Secular two is that our religious institutions are weaker and weaker. Resources are down, budgets are down. Fewer and fewer people are going to church. Usually when we talk about church is hard because of the secular, we think our issue is fewer and fewer people are participating. So it moves from demonstrate to participate. So now the best kind of churches, the best kind of pastors, the best kind of preaching is to win participation. We feel like there's almost a battle at play between religious spaces and a-religious spaces. Especially in middle-class settings, you feel like parents and families are so, they're driven so much more by a-religious spaces, like sports and piano. They'll drive all around the state for all this stuff. But just getting them to come to church on Wednesday night, that's a hard sell. So there becomes this temptation of how could we just make our programs, how could we just make our church something that people would participate in? And we start to have this rhetoric, again, that the best pastor, that the best church can win participation. Now, I don't want to be flippant about this. This is an issue. Decline of people does matter. And if you oversee a church's budget, you know that. We know that most churches in America, most Protestant churches particularly, are one roof leak away from being done. One roof leak, one $800,000 bill, one $500,000 bill they were not expecting, they will be over. And if you are a pastor of a church, you feel this. You know you lose more members, it's a problem. Teaching in a denominational seminary, we're very aware that you lose more members and more congregations, you need fewer pastors, therefore you need fewer seminaries. This is a big deal. However, I'm not so sure what it means to live in a secular age is that fewer and fewer people are going to church. I'm not sure that's really what it means to live in a secular age, and yet we often think it is. I think what it means to live in a secular age is what we might call secular three. All right, now I have, after lunch, a lot of plates spinning here, and you have food in your stomach, and all the blood is rushing to your stomach, so let me just review this really quickly. If secular one is a public-private divide, and once it arrives, it is here. You never outgrow it. It's here. But secular two, we think, is the loss of people. It is the fewer and fewer people are participating. Then what is secular three? This is what secular three is. Secular three is when all forms of belief become contested. Or another way of saying this is when all forms of belief become fragilized. It's to live with a sense of fragilization. In other words, we are very aware that other people that live right across the street believe something very different than us, and they seem to be doing okay. Or we're very aware for ourselves that we could believe something very differently and could still live in our neighborhood and could still have our kids go to this school, that we're aware we could believe something quite different. So to live in a secular three age, there's both a positive to this and a negative to this. But I don't want you to think of this pejoratively, like there's a good thing and there's a bad thing. I want you to think of it like a battery, where there's a plus and there's a minus, and they have to be lined up to get the battery to function. And honestly, people, that's all I know about electrical engineering, is that right there. But you have to have both of those or the thing doesn't work. So here is the negative reality of secular three. The negative reality of secular three is that the commitment, the imagination even, that there is a transcendent reality, or that there is a living, moving God who is acting within history, becomes just more and more unbelievable to people. Not even as a direct rejection, just as, how do you hold on to that? I don't even think about that. That people, and we know that if you ask people empirically, do they believe in God? Most will still check yes, but they can all, and most of us can all function as if there is no transcendent reality. Or the fact that people can say things, and people say this all the time, you've heard them say it, where they'll say things like, well, I'm just going to take a break from God for a while. I just need a break from God for a while. And we all, for the most part, I would imagine everyone in this room finds that somewhat coherent. Like, yeah, okay, get that. Our ancestors in the faith would find that the most shocking thing you could ever say. It'd be like saying, I'm going to take a break from air for a while. Like, it was not a possible reality. But we find it plausible. We can even hear pastors who will say things like, if I was really honest, I would admit I haven't really thought about God in months. I mean, I've preached sermons and I've led all the stuff of church, but really thought about God, it's been months. The fact that you can inhabit this kind of world and make those kind of statements shows you live in this kind of secular age. But there is also a positive to this, and the positive side of this is that in a secular three age, people deeply, deeply long for meaning and feel like they have to find it themselves. That's why this kind of secular age is a very strange one, where what it produces is a surplus of spiritualities. That everyone needs to become spiritual as a way of finding meaning, but it becomes a completely open and very crowded buffet of which spiritualities will help them find which kind of meaning. So, of course, many of you know this, that as I'm doing this, I'm actually just giving you, in a synthesis form, Charles Taylor's thesis in his big, thick book called A Secular Age, which is 770 pages. It is a perfect book to keep your door open on a very windy day. It will do the trick very, very well. So in 770 pages, Taylor just wants to answer one question. And the question is basically what I've unfolded for you here in the last 20 minutes. And the question is, why in 1500 in the West, in just a big round number in 1500, was it nearly impossible to not believe in God? And in a short 500 years later, just staying with those big round numbers, it has completely flipped. And in most places across the West, it is easier to not believe in God than to believe in God. For instance, like in France, or in Scandinavian countries, or in the UK, easier to not believe in God than to believe in God. What happens here? Well, you have to read 770 pages just to answer that one question, and then it gets worse. You really have to read it three times before it really makes any sense. So that does make you dizzy and want to vomit a little bit. But some of us keep reading them because he says something like this that I think is really fascinating. He says, this kind of secular age, secular three, the fragilization that happens in it is a two-way fragilization. It's a two-way fragilization. It works like this. If you are someone who believes, like himself, a committed Catholic, practicing Catholic, he says, if you're someone who believes, you cannot help it. You will have moments where you will find your belief fragilized, where you will think to yourself, is this true? Or is this just the family I grew up in? I mean, if I would have grown up in a different family somewhere else in the world, would I believe this? No, it's true. You go on, and then you find your belief fragilized again. You think, well, is religion true? Or is this just an evolutionary trick? I mean, is this just false pattern recognition all the way down? No, it's true. You can't help it. The people in your churches, all of us who sit in this room, at one time or not, we find ourselves fragilized. You cannot escape that, is his point. But, like I said, it works the other way. Let's say you're a young adult and you don't believe. You live in Brooklyn. You've been to an elite university. You don't believe any of this. And actually, what you believe is that you don't believe. And that's you. That's what it is. You know what religion is. What religion is a historical reality used by powerful people to keep other people down. And when you die, you go to heaven. Grow up. Just grow up and face reality. Your life is like a TV set. It's on. When it gets unplugged and it goes blank screen, you die. That's what life is. That's what you believe is that you don't believe. Taylor's point is you too will have moments where your unbelief is fragilized and you have moments of believing. For instance, you go to that Christmas concert that your sister begged you to go listen to your nephew at the Christmas concert. And you're just there to keep her off your back. And then all of a sudden it starts. Ba-ba-ba-ba-bum. The Bach music begins and something reaches for you. And you have a moment of feeling grabbed for, like there's something bigger out there, like there's something reaching for you and your unbelief is fragilized and you have a moment of believing. Or another one is you hear that your mother's died. So you fly home to see your mother. You knew she was sick, but you didn't think she would die this quickly. You get home, it's very sad. You're there for the burial. You're there for the funeral. You're there for the burial. You spend the time at your cousin's house. After the burial, you gather with your siblings and your cousins, you tell stories about your mom. You laugh and you cry some more and you laugh. Your brother tells a story about, remember how when mom used to clean the kitchen? She'd put on that 80s pop song and she'd dance around the kitchen. And you talk about how embarrassed you were when she would do this in high school, but now it makes you miss your mom all the more. Well, you go to bed late with a few drinks in you and you have an early flight the next morning. And you sleep past your alarm and you wake up and you realize you got to get to the airport. You got to get to the airport quick. So you throw all your clothes into your suitcase and you race out to that rental car that's parked in your cousin's driveway and you've left the radio on. You start the car, you back up, and there it is. That same pop song is on the radio. And you have a choice. Inside a secular three age, you have a choice. You can think, oh my gosh. Jeffrey Bezos is listening to everything we say all of the time. Or you can wonder. You can wonder, is there something more? Is there something out there? Is there something even compelling me to search for something? Is there a greater something out there? Well, whether we believe and we're fragilized, or we don't believe and we find our unbelief fragilized and find ourselves believing, we live in what Taylor calls the imminent frame. We all exist inside the imminent frame. This is what Taylor says. He says, the imminent frame is a constructed social space that frames our lives entirely within a natural rather than a supernatural order. It is the circumscribed space of the modern social imaginary that precludes transcendence. All right, that makes you really tired and makes your eyes. I think it is proven that philosophers have tryptophan in their quotes. So this is like making you super, super tired. So let me help this make a little sense. And let's just turn to a pop star's lyrics to illustrate this point he's trying to make. Now that makes me feel really cool. Like I'm going to show you pop star's lyrics. This song's like 15 years old. But don't pay attention to that. just think I'm cool. So this comes from a British pop star named Lily Allen. I don't know if you remember Lily Allen. She was hot 15 years ago. I mean, really, really important. This is the most controversial statement I will say. Lily Allen, if you don't remember her, is really who Katy Perry is trying to be. All right, that makes me very controversial. But I did not mention the name Taylor Swift, so you do not have license to hurt me. If I did, then you could do whatever. But here is lyrics from her song called The Fear. She says this. She says, life's about film stars and less about mothers, but it doesn't matter because I'm packing plastic, and that's what makes my life so effing fantastic. All right, first of all, folks, I have no idea what that means. No clue whatsoever what packing plastic means. Probably means she has a credit card with a major credit limit on it. More than likely, it means she's had one part of her body surgically enhanced. But nevertheless, that becomes the measure of the good life. But you get the vibe here. Very, very, very poppy, but also very, very irreverent. Middle finger waved in your face. But this is the lyric I want you to see. She says, now I'm a weapon of massive consumption. It's not my fault. It's how I'm programmed to function. And here it is. This is the imminent frame. Now I'm not a saint, but I'm not a sinner. Now everything's cool as long as I'm getting thinner. Now I'm not a saint and I'm not a sinner, but everything's cool as long as I'm getting thinner. This is the imminent frame. Her basic point is, saint, sinner, never kept me up at night. Not once have I woke up in the middle of the night in a cold sweat wondering, what does God think of me? Am I a saint or am I a sinner? Am I bound for heaven or am I bound for hell? I mean, folks, for most people, for 500 years, at least in the West, they cared about this question. This question kept them up at night. I mean, poor Martin Luther couldn't sleep when he went to the Erfurt Monastery wondering, is he a saint or is he a sinner? He wore out his confessor 6 hours a day, it was reported, from Luther's own pen, that he once confessed for 6 straight hours. Left the confessor. I mean, think of that, 6 straight hours. That's 2 Lord of the Rings movies. Like, just confessed for 2 Lord of the Rings movies. He leaves the confessional, thinks to himself, man, I feel unburdened by this confession, and then wonders, should I feel bad for feeling unburdened? And tried to return and go back to the confessional. And his confessor is like, Marty, you got to do something before you come back here. I can't handle this. But Lily Allen is saying, saint, sinner, never kept me up. Never lost 1 minute of sleep wondering, am I a saint or am I a sinner? Now, what's fascinating is she's lost sleep. She's lost a great deal of sleep. She's been woken up and overwhelmed by anxiety in the middle of the night. It has just not been, what does a divine force think of me? Have I broken God's law? Have I broken the commandments? Her fears are not transcendent. They are imminent. And her imminent fears are real fears. Swimsuit season's coming. What are people going to think of me? There's a certain assumption, and it was an assumption that started in the Enlightenment, really out of Paris, and Voltaire used to say this, if we could just get these overweening priests off our back, we'd never feel guilty again. We wouldn't have to feel guilty again. Well, you spend some time with upwardly mobile middle-class Americans, most guilt-ridden group of people you'll ever meet. What's fascinating about them is what they feel guilty about is not to God. They feel guilty to themselves. They let themselves down. They could have done more. They could have been brave and started the podcast. They could have started the business. They could have, and they didn't. And so she feels a great amount of anxiety, but you see it's not a transcendent reality. It's an imminent one. This is what Taylor means by the imminent frame. So Taylor says this, we can't help looking over our shoulders from time to time, looking sideways, living our lives in a sense of faith, living our faith in a condition of doubt and uncertainty. And Lily Allen, she has this probing existential dynamic in the chorus as well, where she says, I don't know what's right or what's real anymore. I don't know how I'm meant to feel anymore when you think it all becomes clear because I'm being overtaken by the fear. All right, now what I should do is play the song for you, right? We should listen to the song. That would be far too obvious. So I want to play a different song for you that makes me feel cool because it comes from an independent band. And if you're ever anywhere, this is one thing to take away from this presentation. If you're ever anywhere and need to feel cool, just say, I know of an independent band. And everyone has to think you're cool. All right, so the truth of the matter is, I didn't know anything about this band. Matt over here from Hamilton told me about it. So he's the cool one if you want to talk to somebody cool. But it is a really interesting song. So this is a song called Margaritas at the Mall by a band called Purple Mountains. It's about a 2-minute song. I just want you to listen to it. You'll see the lyrics come up. And I want you just to make note of what lyric grabs your attention. Now, there's 2 things you didn't know as you listen to the song. First is that this is a very catchy song. So I have to apologize to you that you will be humming this song for about 2 weeks. So I really, really apologize for that. If you are of age where you get up to use the bathroom in the middle of the night, at 3 a.m, you'll be walking back to bed humming Margaritas at the Mall, and you will curse my name. But when that happens, what I want you to do is I want you to stop, and I want you to pray. And I want you to say, God, are you telling me now to go onto Amazon and buy an Andy Root book? Okay, I'm kidding. You don't have to do that. That's a completely consumer joke. I apologize. The one thing you honestly do need to know about this is this song is written by a guy named David Berman, and you just need to know he has never spent one day in a church. He wasn't an old youth group kid who left the church and now is longing to get back. This is a guy who thought long ago there was no reason for religion, there was no reason for faith, and yet now here he is in maybe his mid-30s or something like that, and he has these deep, longing questions. What lyric jumped out to you? Just someone yell out one or two. Yeah, there you go. Yeah, it's always fun to hear groups laugh at that one because it feels so true too, probably, yeah. Others? Yeah, how long can the world go on under such a subtle, with no new word from God? How long, or maybe it's the other way. How long can the world go on under such a subtle God? How long can the world go on under no new word from God? It's fascinating. Assertion, which is really Charles Taylor's point. The great accomplishment of the West is not to eliminate God from it. God still is somewhat part of our discourse and language, and even in a political season coming up, people will talk about God all the time, but God becomes quite a subtle reality. This has been quite an accomplishment of our society to make God quite subtle, but there are ramifications to the subtleness, and this actually has quite a sad story to it. David Berman, who is the writer of this song, we often hear this, we've seen this on social media, that belief has its consequences, that there's so many toxic Christian communities out there, that belief could be damaging to your health. But we should also remember that just that's true, but at the other side of it, unbelief has its consequences too. Having no belief has its consequences too. And tragically, David Berman ended up killing himself at the beginning of the pandemic. I mean, asking deep, deep probing questions. He finds that there's not much here. There's not much to this. Without a speaking God within the world, what do you get to replace it? What do you get is, well, you get malls and margaritas. Is that enough? Is there enough here for that? This happy hour indeed has us by the balls, that it there's not enough to live here for, he wonders. But what I find really fascinating as we start to bring ourselves to conclusion here is how often you talk to folks across Protestantism who are quite frightened about the future of the church, quite frightened about the future of the Confession of Christianity, and how quickly they say things to me like, you know what we need at our church? We need a margarita machine. All right, no one has ever said to me, they need a margarita machine, because I would be a member of that church if that was that case. But I cannot tell you how many people have said to me, if we just had better coffee, if we just had a better marketing program. And remember at the beginning I told you that there's a problem here, that out of our best intentions, if we get this wrong on what we think the secular is, it could make matters worse. This is it. We think the issue is about participation, and what could get more people to come is to turn our churches into malls and have margarita machines there and better coffee. What you end up doing is caging people even deeper in the imminent frame. That religion itself is not about opening up to hear the voice of a living God speak again, but it really becomes about how we can give value to your participation. That just perpetuates the imminent frame. So what do we do with this? How do we respond to this? Let me just leave you with one story that I think illustrates maybe a way forward in a way that's, I think, hangs deeply on the cross. So a few years ago, I had read a book that many of you have read this book before by the anthropologist. This book won quite a few awards. T.M. Lerman wrote this book, Tanya Lerman, called When God Talks Back. I don't know if you've heard this book or know this book. Like I said, it won a few awards. And what she wanted to do is she said she wanted to look at another divide in our culture that we often don't talk about. And there's a divide of people who talk quite easily about God speaking to them. God talks to them about all sorts of things. And then you have another group of people, who is a bigger group of people, who finds anyone who talks like that to be out of their mind. Like this is baseline schizophrenia or something. So she decided she wanted to study this divide. So as a good anthropologist, she moved in with this small group of people who say that God speaks to them quite often. So she joined a vineyard church in outside of Chicago, spent 3 years in a vineyard congregation, moved to Northern California, spent another 3 years with another vineyard community, 6 years. She comes to the end of her book. It's beautiful at the end of her book. She says, absolutely not. We cannot say that. She says, now can we say that these people who hear God speak to them, that it's God who speaks to them? She says, well, I mean, you don't get tenure at Stanford for saying God talks to people. So I'm not going to say that. But she says this. She says, I can tell you that during the process of living with these people, my father died. And these people prayed for me. And it got me through. And I found that incredibly fascinating. But then I thought to myself, well, what would happen if you went to different traditions? Like in a vineyard tradition, you say God speaks to you, you get patted on the back. You go to a Lutheran or a Presbyterian congregation and say God speaks to you, people, you know, they don't pat you on the back, they step back. Like they find that to be very odd. So I did this thing for this monograph book called Christopraxis, where I went and I interviewed just 12 people. That's all I needed for my sample. But I did this thing called life history interviewing, where you write 6 big questions. You have an hour-long conversation. With their permission, you record it, you transcribe it, you look for themes. And I just wanted to see how people would respond to if they've ever had an experience where God spoke to them. So these 12 people from 2 Lutheran churches and a Presbyterian church, I asked them, have you ever had an experience where God spoke to you? I had one man in his 70s say, oh, I hate it. I hate it when anyone ever says God speaks to them. I don't trust those people. If anyone says God speaks to them, I just turn them off. I think that's pure manipulation. Except one time. Everyone out of those 12 people had an at least one time experience. They were beautiful stories. I mean, incredibly beautiful. I said to them, have you ever told anyone in your church this story? I felt privileged to hear these stories. Have you ever told anyone in your church this story? Nope. Never told anyone in my church. I said, surely you told your pastor, because that's why your pastor nominated you to talk to me. You've told your pastor this story, right? Nope. Never told my pastor this story. How long can the world go on under such a subtle God? The God of Israel is moving and speaking, and yet we don't speak it. The imminent frame locks us in to not give proclamation to these stories. The most powerful one I did is what I want to end with. It was a woman, the youngest woman in my sample. She was probably mid-30s. She came into her pastor's office at this Presbyterian church, and she looked like she wanted to be anywhere but talking to me. Her pastor had asked her to do this. She loved her pastor, but she was basically kind of doing this the whole time. She wasn't, but basically like, just get through this. Let's go. Every question I had, she answered it in 2 sentences and wanted to move forward. She kept on telling me, I'm a single mom. I'm a single mom. I'm really busy. I'm a single mom. I'm really busy. I'm a single mom. Got to the end. I had just a few more minutes. It had been deeply painful. And I thought, okay, I got one more question. She doesn't want to be here. This maybe just doesn't work, but let me just ask this one last question. So I just kind of riffed this question, and I said to her, I said, Rachel, have you ever had an experience where you felt so deeply ministered to that you were sure it was the very presence of Jesus Christ? Have you ever had that experience? Her whole disposition changed, and she says, I have, but I've never told anyone this story. And then she went on to say that I've been telling you that I'm a single mom, but I've never told you why I'm a single mom. I'm a single mom because 4.5 years ago, my husband got on an airplane. He flew from Seattle to Chicago. He was supposed to be gone 3 days. He was gone just over 13 hours, and I got a phone call. It was a young man from the hotel my husband had stayed at, and he was very awkward. And he tried to continue to tell me something, but he stopped and started. And he said, ma'am, hi, I'm calling from the hotel that your husband stayed at last night. I'm calling because, ma'am, well, here's the situation. So, let me start over. So, ma'am, I'm calling because, well, there's been I've never done anything like this before. So, ma'am, the reason I'm calling is it seems to be, I'm sorry, I'm very nervous. So, ma'am, here's the situation. She said he couldn't get the words out. She had no idea what was going on here. Finally, he gathered himself and he said, ma'am, I'm calling because, well, ma'am, I'm calling because your husband, ma'am, your husband is dead. And he went on to explain that the housekeeping crew went into her husband's room this morning, found that he was unconscious, still in bed. They called an ambulance. The ambulance came. They announced that he was dead. They had said he probably had died somewhere in the middle of the night. He said, I'm calling you now, ma'am, because I'm supposed to give you the hospital morgue that your husband's body's been sent to. My manager is dealing with the paramedics and others now. And she said, when he said this, it made no sense. Like, she couldn't make it make any sense. Like, it just, the words didn't compute. And then when they all kind of fell into place, the first thought she had to herself was, my life is over. How do I move on from this? She looked into the living room and she said her first visceral experience was the color being sucked out of the room. Like, she was now living in black and white. She looked on the floor and she had a preschooler and her toddler. And the first thought that went in her mind was, my life is over. My life is over. She got out a little business card. She wrote the hospital morgue address on it. She hung up the phone. She called her mother to come stay with her children, and she flew to Chicago. She said she knew no one in Chicago. The plan was to land in Chicago, identify the body, sign the paperwork that needed to be signed, have the body shipped back to Seattle, and go home. She said, I got on that flight. It lasted 3 minutes. It lasted 3 days. She said, I was drowning in grief so much, I didn't feel like my body was in time. She said, got to O'Hare Airport. She went down to the cab stand. She gave the cabbie the card with the address on it, and he drove. She said, I should have noticed this, but I didn't notice anything. I was drowning in my grief. I didn't notice that he parked the car. She said, she walked into the hospital morgue. They had her itinerary. They knew when she would be there. They immediately took her to a side room. She said, I stood there for about a minute and a half. It felt like a day and a half. She said, then it happened. The doors on the other side of the room opened. A man pushed a gurney in, and there it was, a body under a sheet. This was it. This was the moment. She said, the man from the hospital morgue grabbed the sheet, started to pull it back. And she says, just as that happened, I felt a hand on my shoulder, and an arm came around the front with a water bottle. And she started to cry, and she said to me, it was the cabbie. It was the cabbie. She said, I never felt more ministered to. She said, I wasn't sure how I was going to put my life back together, but I knew God had not abandoned me, that Jesus Christ had seen me through. And then she said it again. I never told anyone that story. How long can the world go on under such a subtle God? My deepest fear for Protestantism is that we are so scared of lost participation that we lose the treasure of these stories, the treasure of testifying and witnessing to this God of Israel, made known in Jesus Christ, who takes what is dead and makes it alive, who comes into the world to minister life out of death. And this God is moving. This God is not moving subtly. This God is always moving hidden, taking the brokenhearted, embracing them, and bringing new life. And just to conclude, I know nothing about that cabbie. Not one thing. She ended the story that way. It was a holy moment, and we held that moment. But I know nothing about that cabbie. But yeah, I imagine he needs a community. He needs to stumble into your church one Tuesday night and say, I got to tell you what happened to me. I have no idea how to make sense of this. I had been working all night. I was on my last run of the day. And this woman came down to my cab stand. This was it. I was going to drop her off. I was going to go home. I'd been working a 12-hour shift. But I caught her eye in my rearview mirror, and I saw sorrow in her eyes. And then I looked at that address, and I knew that place. Because when my cousin Ronnie had his heart attack, that's where they took his body. And I remember my auntie throwing herself on the floor there. So I drove. I should have just dropped her off and went home, showered, and been done with it. But I got there, and I heard something. It must have been the Holy Spirit. I heard something. But I heard it clear as day. I heard it say, do not leave her alone. Whatever you do, do not leave her alone. But I didn't know what to do. So I just went and I stood with her. He needs a community. He needs a pastor who will say, behold, you have been a servant of the Lord. God has moved. God is acting. This kind of secular age is an age where we need people to testify to a God who takes what is dead and brings life out of it, that shares in each other's persons as a very sacrament of a God who shares so deeply in our humanity, that God takes all death and brings life out of it. Let me pray for us. God, thank you for these people. And thank you for the ministries that they have, for the ways they witness to the depth of your love for the world. Bless us, God, and give us eyes to see and ears to hear, and to recognize the ways that you are coming and bringing new life out of death. Amen.